You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
BBC reporter Kate Adie was on duty when the Iranian embassy siege took place in London in 1980. As the SAS stormed the building to rescue hostages cooped up inside, Adie described the events unfolding in front of her to an audience of millions while crouched behind a car door. Her coverage of the event broke new ground for television reporting, and she went on to report from war zones around the world. Ahead of the film festival screening of 6 Days, a film depicting what went down at the Iranian embassy, Adie came up to 95BFM studio to have a chat with our news director Shamina about her experiences during the siege and what she thinks of the state of the media today.
One of your earliest breakthroughs as a journalist was your coverage of the Iranian embassy siege in 1980. So you were on duty when it went down. So can you talk me through how it all started?
We got a call in the newsroom. This is the national television newsroom in BBC in London. And it was one of those odd calls which said there's trouble down at somewhere near Hyde Park in the centre of London. And you have to remember, this was a time when we had an enormous amount of terrorist activity. The IRA was active both in Northern Ireland and on the mainland and in London particularly, and several other groups. So we just said, here we go, it's another problem. And I went with a film crew, and we went down to Princess Gate, which is near, right in the centre of London, near the Royal Albert Hall. And it was an embassy building. There was a lot of trouble. You could see police were just coming onto the scene, and there was confusion. We went right in front of the building. They hadn't cordoned anything off in those days quickly. And we could see that something had happened right in front of us, about sort of six, 7 yards away beyond the gate. There was trouble at in the door was shut, and police were sort of milling around. And it turned out that a bunch of men had got into the embassy a short time earlier and had shot their way in, and they now had hostages inside. And that's all we gathered in those first few minutes. We were all then pushed back. And then the oddest thing occurred, and that was, after a bit of kerfuffle, having called the newsroom, and I have to say, we had to find a public telephone. This is when you realise how long ago it was.
So like a phone box?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So elbowed other hacks out the way, got into the phone box.
From the BBC, move over.
And called the newsroom and said, there really is, something big going on here. The police are really, sort of on edge. There's guns involved. There are hostages inside. We know it's the Iranian embassy. And as a voice in the newsroom, there were a number of sort of calls about this, but at one point said, do you know, we sent a couple of guys this morning from the newsroom to get a visa. Oh, where was it? Iraq? Iran? Where? One of the Iranian? Was there an Iranian embassy? Oh, boy. We realized we had two people inside who'd gone for a visa that morning.
Wow.
And that was really, when you're a journalist, you suddenly realise that you have an extra involvement in a story, not just watching as a journalist. And Sim Harris and Chris Kramer, two of our newsroom people, are actually being held hostage along with the staff. So that was the start of it. And that was in the middle of the week, and the siege started. They were making demands, the terrorists, and the British government had a pretty strong line that it didn't yield to hostage demands. And that was it. So we sat it out for 6 days. And the world's media arrived at Princess Gate in London. And there we were, the largest, messiest picnic outside the park you ever saw. And we sat there 24 hours a day. I didn't do all of it. I went down on shift as a ordinary reporter does, because I wasn't one of the senior people, until the final 6th day. And I was called in early because another reporter wanted to go off his board. And he said he had a dinner party to go to that night. So I was called in and they said, do you mind coming in early? I came in.
Do you reckon that was just an excuse because he was like, I can't handle this?
Or... No. He was genuinely, he hadn't seen much happen that day.
Oh, okay.
And off he went. And within half an hour of myself arriving, this had nothing to do with what happened. Bingo, in went the SAS in one of the most spectacular, I suppose, actions that we've ever seen. And we saw it in the sense, we being the British public and internationally, because we had an outside broadcast unit down there and it went live, and we got, and this is rare even today, we got the actual breaking of the siege and the SAS going in live on camera. And I was there.
Right, because from what I understand, the BBC halted their sports coverage.
No, not... Well, it's sports coverage. The snooker championships. Oh. It sounds bizarre all of these years later. But snooker had suddenly become the great popular sport on telly. It went through
one of those
sort of periods, you know. Everybody was absolutely riveted to the snooker finals held in Sheffield. And that was going on live, and we just cut straight in. There was no announcement. We just cut straight to it. It was highly unusual in those days. There were no news channels, you see. 24 hours didn't exist. All of this. And it was such a shock. And the enormous audience, and there were, I think, something like 18 million watching the snooker finals. And then, with this coming live, everybody phoned their mates, and we ended up with over 21 million people watching live.
That's amazing. Yeah, because also from what I understand, you're not only that method of broadcasting was quite unusual, but also your style of reporting was quite unusual as well for the time, that it was improvised, off-script type of thing.
It was unusual in the sense that, and I have to say this today, having done 30-odd years in the business and having done a lot of stories about terrorism and such like, to actually see something unfold in front of you is very, very rare. Mm. When you go to the movies, you think, well, you know, it all happens in front of journalists. No, it doesn't. It all happens after you arrive. When I wrote my autobiography, I thought I might call it, this was some years ago, the phrase I'd had most frequently in my career, which was, oh, you should have been here yesterday, because that's what journalists always experience. We don't have a crystal ball. So to be there and to have it happening in front of you and with no explanation, no information, except what you can see, I had to then, on the spot, sort of drag into my brain every single bit of discipline about what you do when you're on air, you're a journalist, and you're seeing things, and you realize you mustn't speculate, you mustn't try and guess, you mustn't try and imagine, just say what you can see, and also give the background to it. And I was on air for nearly half an hour, watching something I had no direct information about from anywhere else except what I was looking at. So you have to stick, to the principles of say what you see. I have to say that seems, again, odd today, because with 24-hour journalism, there's quite a lot of speculation comes into life, purely because they have 24 hours to fill. And so it seems, in a curious way, a bit of a period piece.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating that with 24-hour news cycle, you'd think that perhaps you'd see more of this, but then because there's that quota that you have to fill all of the time, people are almost more in the newsroom, right? Because they use press releases or whatever to churn out the content to fill
the... Two things have happened. One is economics, in the sense that there are fewer people on the road in a curious way. That always amazes people when you see a horde of journalists chasing someone down a street or gathered around a famous politician or whatever. But newsrooms worldwide, particularly in the Western media, are having a bit of an economic crisis. Mm. There are fewer people out there. People rely on sitting there and phoning people or whatever, using some social media as well, which is unverified. So there are dodgy problems there. And the second thing is that even when you've got television, there was a good example last year when we had the problems in both France and Brussels with terrible attacks in Paris and Brussels. You don't know where the action is going to move to. And it was very fast moving, for example, in Paris, with terrorists on the run and with different events here and there, same in Brussels a short time later. The cameras don't know, and television's still quite bulky, and you've still got to get a signal. With all the technology we've got, it's quite difficult. And it may well be dangerous. The police may also try and keep you away from things. So the idea that you can follow something live on television is a fond idea, and it's really just that. It happens very rarely. Mm. And we got one of those moments all of those years ago. And wow, it's quite extraordinary to think back to it.
Mm. I mean, I guess there is kind of also the rise of citizen journalists who might be at the scene these days, who are, you know, not journalists, but happen to be there with their smartphones.
Well,
and then
let me give you a hypothetical, and that is, these days, what would we do as television broadcasters if we were getting from the smartphones of the people holding guns to people's heads, threatening to kill them? What would we do? There are so many ethical questions now, and there are so many problems with footage, that we live in quite a tricky age of deciding what we show, what we should show, what we can show, what people want to see, what people ought to see. These are immense questions which technology has now thrown up.
I mean, I guess one example of that is with particular areas where ISIS exists in the world at the moment, where, you know, journalists are quite rare because it's so dangerous, and ISIS has a very prolific news agency that puts out a lot of their videos, and so puts news broadcasters in that ethical dilemma. It's like, well, if we use this footage, are we giving them a platform? But then also
it's much more complicated than that. You're right on that point, very definitely, but there are other points. All I would say is, what we have, to be honest, is embarrassed, huffy professional journalists saying, good Lord, other people have got the same equipment as us and the same skills and the same technical skills, if not the same set of values, the same set of ethics, the same set of responsibilities. Now, that's us going, how dare they have the means of broadcasting and look so slick and professional. That's life, folks. They have. And we've got to come to terms with it. It's been coming for some time, and people have been ignoring it. The people in the business have felt a bit bothered by it. But now it's coming straight to us. And also, it's a question, really, for the audience, for people in democratic countries. What do you want to see and have available to you on your own screens, phones, tablets, whatever? What do you think you should look at? And it's a big question, because it comes back to the most fundamental thing I learned as a little junior, you know, long, 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 long time ago. And that was, do you give people, as we sit in this studio, what we think they ought to have, or do we give them what they want? That's it. It can be boiled down to that simple question. And it is a very big question.
think.
Well, exactly. I mean, I guess it's a thing that when media business models are commercial, that it makes that question so hard to really unpack and, you know, come out with the right answer that is the most beneficial, because there are competing values that exist here, you know, this commercial imperative versus...
Well, there's more than that. I think there's a much more fundamental democratic argument. I've been fascinated over the years of journalism, where my job is to stick my truffling little nose into things. And as someone said to me in a newsroom, your job is to walk into a room and pick up the carpet and find out what they've swept under it. Now, that's one of the definitions of a certain kind of journalism. But it is one's job to find out what's going on. I have a very fundamental view of the importance of democracy and of being informed. And yet, I frequently face groups of people who say to me things like, no, the government knows better. And you know, there are things which should be kept secret, and it's for our own good, and we think that people ought to be able to gather this information, not let us know what they're doing. I mean, and I'm sitting there with my mouth open going, hey, I want to know. And I am faced, and there may be people listening who say, no, there are things which really it's better off if people in command, people in the know, people who are clever, people who are experts, people whom we voted there, people at the top. And that's a very strong feeling in quite a lot of quarters. So that's what we're really faced with now, because if everyone else gets the means of broadcasting, then that throws open the possibilities of all sorts of stuff reaching everyone on their little mobile phones at home, you know, with no question of any intervening broadcasting authorities then. Just what sort of world are we going into? One where we're all better informed, or one where we're also overwhelmed by information, or whether we all get the sort of stuff that people in power, everybody from dictators to democratic governments, think we ought not to know.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Kate Adie is in the country as a guest of the New Zealand International Film Festival. The film 6 Days, based upon the events of the 1980 Iranian embassy siege, screens tonight at the ASB Waterfront Theatre at 8:45 and tomorrow night at Rialto Cinemas Newmarket at 8:15. Kate Adie will be in attendance for a Q&A after both screenings.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.